The Department of International Relations celebrates its 75th anniversary during this academic year. The subject was taught in various forms before 1927, but it really was the founding of the department and then the sponsoring of the Philip Noel Baker Chair by Montagu Burton from 1930 onwards that it really became truly established. Three quarters of a century on, the department has 28 full members of staff, two tutorial fellows, hosts nearly 500 students each year, a good proportion of whom are in here tonight, as well as teaching many other students from related departments. We're celebrating our anniversary in various ways, but there is no fitting way than this, the first of our special anniversary lectures, in which Christopher Hill will speak about what is to be done, foreign policy as the site for political action. This lecture arises from his recently published book, The Changing Politics of Foreign Policy, and Palgrave have asked me to tell you that if you go to the entrance after the lecture, you can buy at a special price both the hardback and the paperback of this book, and I'm sure with a little bit of persuasion, the author can be persuaded even to sign it. It gives me particular pleasure to chair this lecture. Everything I ever knew about foreign policy analysis, I know from Christopher Hill. Even before I came to the LSE to teach, I used to come and get his course outlines and dash down to the University of Surrey and teach the course there. I then, of course, appointed him the external examiner, so my students did extremely well. He is the Montagu Burton Professor of International Relations. He was the convener of the department between 1994 and 1997. Most recently, 1999 until last year, he was the vice chairman of the academic board, a king-making position, if I might say so, and very influential. He's also very well known in the British International Studies Association. He was the chair from 1999 to 2000, the honorary president from 2001 to 2002. He's also very well known at the Royal Institute of International Affairs. Apart from teaching foreign policy analysis, he teaches a lot about European foreign policy, and his publication has been primarily in the field of European foreign policy and changing politics of foreign policy. I'm sure that you're all looking forward to him telling us what is to be done.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Margot, for that most kind introduction. It's the first time in my life and probably the last I'll ever been called the kingmaker, I fear. I saw my role much more as Speaker of the House, but I suppose that has its powers as well. Anyway, it was enjoyable, but it wasn't as enjoyable as being a member of this department, actually. When I was thinking about this lecture and the anniversary, our 75th anniversary, I realised that I'd been in the department for 27 or 28 years. That was more than a third of the department's life. This was a great shock to me. You're supposed to be a shock to you as well, you're supposed to say. It's impossible to imagine, of course, such a youthful appearance and all the rest of it. But the department has been going a long time, but of course quite a historically short time in terms of the nature of scholarship and learning about international matters. As you know, international relations is a relatively new discipline. But it has been, I think, the LSE, a very important place in establishing the subject. I mean, together with Aberystwyth, which is, of course, the older department in this country, the oldest in the world, it's been one of two very important centres. And I think that, although I don't want to go on about the department and the anniversary, it's not the main theme of what I want to say, but I do want to say that I think that without departments like our own and Aberystwyth and many others that have developed in the UK, it would have been much more difficult to study seriously the international dimension of human life, because it would otherwise have been tacked on in other departments, in other social sciences, a kind of extra which is desirable, and it's necessary that people do that as well as what we do. But I think most of us are convinced, and not just through self-interest of having got jobs in these departments, that we do need serious, focused study on the international as a dimension. That doesn't just mean the state system, it means a whole lot of other things as we know now. But we have to try to retain that. Right, let me go on to the lecture which I'm giving today, What is to be Done? Foreign Policy as a Site for Political Action. My main aim here, and indeed in the book which you were kind enough to mention, is to liberate the idea of foreign policy, and to liberate it in two respects. One, for the audience of specialised international relations scholars and students, to liberate it from what I see as a bit of an intellectual cul-de-sac in which it has got itself, or it has been placed, or whatever, over the last 10 or 15 years, rather unjustly and certainly, I think, undesirably from a whole range of perspectives. From a wider public audience point of view, I want to liberate the idea of foreign policy perhaps from more traditional conceptions that foreign policy is somehow a kind of realist activity associated only with state power politics, that it's doomed to be conducted by the dark forces we heard something of recently. And it's a very specialised business which the public has no business getting involved in, except of course when required to serve through conscription or getting themselves involved in international relations at the margins in tourism and all the rest of it. Now, my title is not deliberately provocative, but certainly a deliberate reference, of course, to Lenin's famous pamphlet of 1902, What is to be Done with a Question Mark. And I also have What is to be Done with a Question Mark, and I actually say foreign policy as a site for political action, not the site for political action. I'll come back to that. Lenin himself took his famous idea, which he used to try and emphasize the importance of building a revolutionary party and to impose revolution from the top down in a disciplined and professional manner. He took that from a novel famous in its day of Nikolai Chernyshevsky's 1862, What is to be Done, I think, without a question mark. I owe that to Margot. Apparently Lenin read this book five times in the first year of its publication. I haven't read it myself, I hasten to add. But it stresses the kind of superhuman hero revolutionary aspect, somebody who is totally self-disciplined, ascetic, puritanical, dedicated to a certain destiny in liberating his people. And that kind of asceticism naturally appealed to Lenin, and he to some extent carried it through in his own life. But the novel, according at least to Orlando Figes, was more about what a revolutionary should be like rather than what a revolutionary was actually to do in terms of not specifying content. What kind of a person, what kind of an activity is revolutionary activity? Now, that is more akin to what I want to do with foreign policy, in the sense that I don't want to spell out what the content of a desirable foreign policy should be. I think we've heard a lot about the debate of ethical foreign policy in recent years in any case, and we probably all have some ideas about the content of a desirable foreign policy these days. That's all to the good. That debate hadn't taken place very much before, at least in our times. But what I want to do is to say something perhaps about what is done in the category under the heading of foreign policy, what can be done, what may be done, to give some sense of the range of it. So I'm not providing a kind of Leninist call to action, providing you with some spark of conviction. I'm sure you've got all that in any case for yourself. In a sense, I want to show the reverse, that foreign policy can be seen as normal politics, especially normal democratic politics, that it shouldn't be kept as a sort of side issue, something separate from those kinds of things we think of when we think of politics in our daily life. I want to show that some kinds of political action can be pursued effectively through foreign policy, others naturally less so. It's stupid to make excessive claims for what sorts of things foreign policy can do. And indeed, that therefore foreign policy is a critical activity for a modern polity, especially for a democracy. Now let me try to set a little more context before I get to the heart of what I want to say. foreign policy as a subject has been discussed, not foreign policy analysis, foreign policy as an idea has been currency for 200, 250 years, I suppose, rather like diplomacy, the idea of which was coined by Burke, but which of course had been talked about in terms of human reflection on the nature of interaction, intercourse, for more than 2,000 years. And so gradually, as we know in the modern era, certain things which human beings tended to do anyway became focused on, became articulated, became crystallized, and became bureaucratized. And that's what happens with foreign policy, with the setting up of foreign ministries from the 18th century onwards. And there was increasing commentary on foreign policy, a technical kind, which you perhaps are familiar with, the work of writers about how to negotiate and so on, François de Calière, Harold Nicholson, Satow, and so on. But also political, gradually, increasingly, in the 19th century, people starting to say something about what the content of foreign policy should be like, and therefore bringing foreign policy more into, if you like, a standard political framework. And one could name a number of people, but in this country, Richard Cobden in France, Jean Jaurès, Woodrow Wilson in the United States, obviously trying to fuse the discussion of the technicalities of diplomacy with the political substance. But despite the more idealistic and radical end of this spectrum, if you like, foreign policy tended to be seen and written about in general as something of great importance for a country's survival and perhaps increasingly for its prosperity in the late 19th and 20th century, but as an area in which mistakes were likely to be simply too serious for one possibly to take the risk of opening up the debate and to allowing too much democratic participation. This was an area not for the inexpert. It was something in which elitism might have a positive meaning as opposed to the often pejorative one which it has come to have in the last 100 years. I would argue that there was a hesitancy between the two world wars on all this in terms of partly post-Wilson, despite Wilson's the failure of the League of Nations project and so on. The sense that this was a more democratic era. This was an era in which foreign policymakers had to respond to the wider will of the people. And indeed, one can understand appeasement in these terms as a sense of the duty that was owed to the dead of 14 to 18, the importance of not treating onset of war lightly, was in a sense an acknowledgement that this was the age of the masses, as Michael Biddis once called it. But after that, after the disasters of 38, 39, and then again 1941. With the Cold War, I suppose the sense of foreign policy being too important to allow too many people to participate in it reasserted itself with the Cold War. And that, from the purely political point of view, was that for a little while. On the intellectual front, however, and as you know, intellectual trends and political ones are far from always being in sync with each other. The development of social science, particularly in the United States, was tending to turn its attention towards foreign policy and to say foreign policy, like every other part of human experience, must be analyzed. It must be dissected on the slab, if you like. Have a public anatomy lesson on the whole thing. And that if we do that, we will increase our understanding, rationality will dawn, and gradually the causes of wars will be better understood. We will be able to make our contribution to prevention. At the moment, we talk a lot about conflict prevention, but the same kind of instinct was at stake in the mid-1950s among some of the early American foreign policy analysts. People like Richard Snyder in particular and Glenn Page, who are the familiar founding fathers of all this. In this country, Joseph Frankel was the first person really to look at foreign policy from an analytical and a coolly distanced point of view, if you like. And I myself came into the area with this very much this kind of mix of the normative of saying, you know, there are terrible things happening in the world, we must do something about it, but the way to do something about it is not to bang the drum and wave a flag for peace or whatever it might be, it's to try and understand it, it's to try and analytically understand it. That means a certain detachment. So there's a paradox about that, which I think was characteristic of very many people in the early phases and perhaps the present day of the study of international relations. Then foreign policy analysis established itself in the 1960s, 1970s, famous books and names like Alison Jervis, Janice, and so on. Graham Allison's Essence of Decision of 1971 probably being the most famous, the classic book in all this. But essentially that was a wave of fashion, intellectual fashion of its own kind. And all waves of fashion pass. It's in the nature of things. It's perfectly desirable. And sometimes it's a kind of intellectual market. If they're no good, they get chucked out and forgotten. It's about like alchemy or something, it disappears. Or perhaps they simply disappear into the kind of water table to resurface at some later stage as an important development, which is what I think and hope is happening here with the study of foreign policy. Certainly by the 1980s, interest in international political economy, in theories and epistemologies of international relations, constructivism, postmodernism, and in the last 10 years, a much more real-world theory, but still one very subversive of the notion of state foreign policy, of course, that of globalization, came on stream. And as a result, there was a certain sort of pushing, shunting to one side of the kinds of things that had interested so many people for that period between about 1958 or something and 1978, say 20 years or so. And my sense would be that actually we've had quite a common phenomenon here. We have tended to throw the baby out with the bathwater, and we must try and recover the baby and resuscitate it if at all possible. However, there are three serious grounds for the trend to move away from thinking seriously about foreign policy. And I want to give them briefly some attention because they deserve it. Three different kinds of skepticism. Skepticism about the role of the state in international relations, skepticism about the idea of the foreign as a discrete category, and skepticism about decision-making approaches to politics and specifically foreign policy. First of all, skepticism about the utility and the durability of the state and therefore of the agency of the state in international relations. And I don't need to give you a mini lecture on this. This is something which is discussed all the time in any university these days, but clearly the whole interest in interdependence and transnationalism, which was evident actually from the 1960s, and transformed itself into globalization theory more recently, in itself fueled by the evident enormous expansion of world capitalism since the Second World War, the trend also to privatization and the sense of the state withdrawing in its domestic role, tended to produce a sense that states were losing control over their own fates, especially their own economic fate, that civil societies weren't any longer so distinctive, there was not so much distinctive culture, culture was an international and transnational business, and that anyway, many of these states that we see in the world were only quasi-states or failed states or non-states, that many of the new states as a result of decolonization had never really been established properly. And this led either to the conclusion that politics was going to take place in a liberal mode, in some form of global governance. We have, as you know, here a centre for the study of global governance, quite right too, to try and look at the processes of cooperation, international institutions, and the rest of it. Or in a more realist, or perhaps even a radical mode, to say, well, no, it's about hyperpower, as the French talk about the United States, or it's about empire in the current discussion, that there is a form of hegemony taking place, whether this hegemony is rooted in one state or it's a kind of octopus model of world capitalism is another thing. But you know, neither of these models really give you much room for foreign policy and state agency in a political sense. And there's quite a lot. There's some truth in this picture painted, but I think it goes too far. Very briefly, I think it rests partly on an idealized version of the past, having been, or a non-idealized, if you like, of being about states and foreign policies and never about structural forces, whereas I think that there's always been continuity on both fronts. It often rests on the very elementary confusion between power and sovereignty, recognizing that states are not all powerful and therefore assuming that they are on the verge of having only an empty shell of sovereignty. They have no actual right or capacity to take decisions about their own fate. They have no suicide option, if you like, even. And I think that this is unfortunately something which we as professionals have not yet managed to translate into the wider public discussion, this very partly because we contest it amongst ourselves, but I think it's nonetheless a rather important and straightforward distinction which holds. Thirdly, because actually in the world the effectiveness of states varies. There's not a sort of one-size-fit-all model about all this. It depends on your geopolitical situation, your internal politics, your phase of development, as to what kind of capabilities you have in international relations. This one would have thought was fairly self-evident. Even among the, say there are 190 states in the world system, I reckon by my count there were about 40 which would fall into a category of mini or micro states. Of those, even in that group of 40, one would say that not all of them were complete ciphers. They were not all corks in the swirling eddies of the tides of international relations. They have got some capacity to exert themselves existentially. Their external strategies matter to them, to their neighbours, and occasionally to the wider system. And one can look at various events in relation to countries like Malta, or now East Timor, or Kuwait, or Slovenia, to say that these are not, the activities they are engaged in are not simply dependent on the activities of others. They're not simply puppets, and they are not insignificant either. Fourthly, still relating to this argument about the state, if agency, political agency, doesn't reside with the state, if the state has, broadly speaking, lost it, where does it reside? Has it just disappeared down the cracks of the international system, not to re-emerge or to re-emerge in some other form? Does it reside with Amnesty International or Rupert Murdoch or the United Nations? Well, powers reside with some of these categories and some of these actors, but not formal political agency. Now, maybe the difference between the formal and the real in Badgett's classic sense of dignified and effective institutions is what we're talking about here. But we also know that many international non-governmental organisations, important as they are, and companies, don't want, quite apart from being capable of, territorial and political responsibility. They want to influence states. They want to pull the strings, if you like, all the time. We can see Mr. Murdoch effectively doing it, probably as we speak. But they don't actually want to take over. You know, firms like Cadbury occasionally did try and take over territorial responsibility for communities, and or Disney, you know, run their workers' lives. But not many people are going to do that. The state's still got quite a lot of life in it, in that respect. And what's more, citizens still expect their governments to act for them when there's something nasty happening to them. They look first and last to their government, and they know that governments, even in weak states, perhaps especially in weak states, are often powerful things to be feared. Then there's all the business about the revival of nationalism and so on, and the fact that people were predicting the end of nation-state and the end of nationalism, and had some nasty shocks in the Balkans and elsewhere. So, by and large, my conclusion on that scepticism is that neither the empire nor the global governance interpretations constitute a realistic description of the world in an overall sense, and there is huge room still left for foreign policy to provide an important focal point for accountability and responsibility in a difficult world. The second form of scepticism is about the category of the foreign itself. The government minister, he was at the time a government minister in the Foreign Office, Peter Hain, about 18 months ago, gave a talk at Chatham House based on a pamphlet which I think was associated with the Greens and with the Fabian Society, called The End of Foreign Policy, which I went to. It was a very entertaining talk. But I think he was wrong. It was very absolutely fascinating that a year later another minister from the same ministry, this time Mr. Dennis McShane, gave a talk called The Return of Foreign Policy, which tells you something about bureaucratic politics, if nothing else. That's also very well worth reading. The text is available for that. Anyway, my point here is that foreign and domestic have never been separated nice and in a nice, clear-cut way, hard and fast way, from each other. You've only got to go back to the 16th century, the wars of religion, the Jesuits penetrating British society, the flow of ideas of Lutheranism and Calvinism across frontiers, to know perfectly well that it is pointless having some kind of straw man idea of a world in which foreign was separate from domestic and now they're all kind of mixed up with each other. Both the kind of errors in both directions. In my view, every entity, organizational entity in the world, whether it's the LSE or Volkswagen on one side, or whether it's the United Kingdom or Brazil in the state system, has an inside and an outside. There is a difference between being in it and being outside it. Maybe there's a problem of overlap, of blurring of boundaries, of the intermestic, as Lincoln Bloomfield called it, but nonetheless, there is a difference between inside and outside, and you know it. I mean, a lot of you work quite hard to get inside the LSE, and there are quite a few people who worked hard, they're very good, and unfortunately didn't get inside the LSE, and it probably makes a difference in their life chances. Anyway, foreign means actually just outside, if you go back to the Latin foris. And perhaps the German here is better than foreign policy. Perhaps Außenpolitik or outer policy is a bit better, because it doesn't have all those, perhaps it does in German, I don't know, but in English, foreign has come to have these pejorative associations of barbaric, threatening, totally cut off and remote and all the rest of it. Foreigners, you know, and therefore there's a reaction against it. We mustn't call people foreigners, because somehow we're saying that they're different. My good friend Andrew Linklater writes about this in The Transformation of Political Community, his latest book of 3 or 4 years ago. I wholly disagree with him about all this. He basically wants a kind of dialogic community in which we dissolve the difference between the foreigner and the citizen or whatever, for very obvious, understandable moral reasons. But I think that it's not necessary, frankly. In our age, it's natural to play down difference, but I think it's a profound mistake to pretend that differences don't exist. And even if we change the terms and political correctness leads us to abolish the idea of foreign policy, and there's a lot of move in that direction, departments of external affairs, departments of global affairs, and so on. You can see it happening. I think that we'll simply have to reinvent it. You know, it's still the same substantive difference, even if the linguistic games are being played. There is always a break point, legally and politically, between those who are inside and those who are outside, and I don't just mean here that the joke point about the LSE, but I mean when it comes to immigration and membership of society, being part of a relatively safe, rich democracy like this one, or being part of a very dangerous environment in Taliban Afghanistan, it makes a huge difference, and one can understand why people want to move from one set of circumstances to another. But also membership of NATO or the EU clearly makes a huge difference, and so the borderline, if you like, even if it's fuzzy in certain respect, it still has an important meaning. Ultimately, I think there is a difference in politics between those things which are, broadly speaking, our business, and we could say the fireman's strike is our business. You know, I'm sure it's of great interest to the Belgians, but it's basically business of the United Kingdom. Those things which are, broadly speaking, other people's business, and here we might disagree, if I said relations between Azerbaijan and Armenia are other people's business, they're not really the UK, some of you might stand up and say, no, it's important, vital, interest, or moral, or whatever. Fine, we'll have an argument about that. But still, broadly speaking, one can say there are some things which are not everything is our business, anyway. And then, of course, there are some things which are just show business, like the royal family, some things that we see on the front of the Daily Mirror every day. The third form of scepticism is the lack of interest or sense that lack of interest in decision-making and sense that it was a sort of exhausted approach to international relations, a move towards structural approaches, whether those structural approaches were neo-realist in terms of looking at the balance of power and saying that was what shaped the really important things that happened, war, peace, and so on, security, or globalization sort of structuralism, say this is the matrix of international means of production, broadly speaking, and that is what is really determining our life chances, our outcomes, and everything else is for the birds. I slightly caricature, evidently. But I think that there has been not only that move away from agency-focused approaches, but where there has been an interest in agency, it has tended to downgrade the kind of inherently empirical approaches of decision-making. Because although there are decision-making theories, they almost always lead you to want to apply them and see whether they actually work in the real world. And those agent-focused approaches we have, which have in fact become very important in modern political science departments of game theory or rational choice, tend to be highly formalistic and to be interested in the nature of strategy and to assume calculation on the part of an optimizing abstract actor of some kind. And I haven't time to dwell on all that, but clearly that is quite a long way away from the understanding of the complexity of bureaucratic and organizational process, or the psychological explanation of foreign policy fiascos, misperceptions, groupthink, and all the rest of it, which depends on empirical work about how foreign policy decisions have been made. And I want to say very briefly now that First of all, the study of foreign policy is not just about decision making. I entirely accept that if one was only to study foreign policy through decision making, it would be a profound mistake. It would be a narrowing and a lack of understanding of the structures of causation with which we have to cope. But as it happens, decision making tells us rather a lot, and they can perhaps, with the help of counterfactual approaches, lead us to ask why it was that the First World War took place when it did in July-August 1914 and not 2 years before or 2 years later, and with the particular conformation of forces that it did, or why it was that there wasn't a nuclear exchange over the Cuban Missile Crisis and so on. A fascinating, rich theoretical and historical literature now on that, well, for the last 20 years on that subject. There are some signs of green shoots, in my view, appearing, more interesting connections being made now, so that there is hope. It's not just Hill banging his drum about foreign policy, but there are signs of wider connections here. One is post-positivism, which has been shown an interest in discourse and the language of foreign policy, which I think has a lot of promise, although unfortunately quite a lot of the writing about it has still been tremendously inaccessible, talking about representational practices and the like. But there are some interesting ideas there, and I think trying to understand why people use the terms that they do, where they get their discourse from, how far national discourse was shared with some other national system, is in itself a rather promising one. But also international political theory, the interest in ethics of foreign policy, which my colleagues in a department like Chris Brown have written a great deal about, but which of course go back also to Stanley Hoffman and Michael Walzer. These are extremely important because they help us to focus on the issues of values, which foreign policy analysts have always been interested in. What are the underlying values of this policy or inherent in the decision-making process? How far are they closing off certain options because of the paradigm that they represent? What is the nature of choice in foreign policy? Anyone who's interested in decision-making is interested in choice. But how do choices get formulated? Why do certain things get on the agenda and not others? And I think that this is an area of very considerable promise. Let me just say a little more about foreign policy conceived of as a meaningful political space. And then I want to go on to outline certain strategies which I think are available to states, mostly states. The idea of private foreign policies is an interesting one and has some mileage, but by and large states for the purposes of argument today. And to show the range and diversity of the kind of action, the things which can be done under the heading of foreign policy in the modern world. First of all, the nature of the political space which is foreign policy. Well, the 11th of September 2001 seemed at a stroke to have rendered some of the kind of anti-politics of writing about international relations foolish. And therefore we need to go back into reverse, talk about security, foreign policy, state and so on. I am not making that argument. I am not saying with Dennis McShane that foreign policy is back. I am saying that it never went away, and that one doesn't need to have this kind of apocalyptical approach to we are in a new age now, everything was different then and now it's all new. Who knows when ages start anyway? I mean, all this is, as we know, anyone who's thought theoretically about international relations or history knows it's very, very artificial and difficult to talk about the start of a particular age in our human experience. So I say that foreign policy never went away, and it has to operate in a multifaceted environment which consists of states of very different natures and situations, various things which we call globalization, which are to do with the growth and integration of the world market and the creation of perhaps a single international economy, and transnational actors, whether terrorist or economic or ideological or educational or whatever. And that's the fascination and the challenge of the whole thing. So the politics of foreign policy is about living in a world which is both foreign and familiar. That is to say, it is both something which is very close to us and we feel we know how to operate, and it's something in which we're groping our way blind. We don't understand. Who had ever heard, you know, in the general public of Al-Qaeda or bin Laden, and suddenly they're part of their everyday mental landscape. And perhaps that's not a great thing. Perhaps one needs to, you know, a less personified approach to the whole thing. But anyway, Foreign policy is, of course, not the only way in which people relate to the world or should relate to the world. But in my view, it is our principal means of coping collectively with the outside world. And I've tried out various definitions of foreign policy over the years, but I think this is probably as pithy a one as I can come up with. It's collective coping with the outside world, and we have, obviously, we have agents who operate on our behalf to manage this coping. And we are doing it 30 or 40 years ago, I think Martin White said that domestic political theory was about the good life, international political theory was about survival. And obviously that was true in some profound sense, but it's not just about survival now, perhaps it even wasn't then. And therefore, collective coping is not simply collective survival, but it's about how to cope with the international political economy, how to cope with the myriad problems that governments have to face to do with public diplomacy or football hooligans or whatever it might be. So in this broader sense, governments mediate the inside-outside problem for their citizens. And citizens, in the first instance, and perhaps the last, have no one else to look to for that task. And that is why, in my view, the support that President Bush has in the United States at the moment is rooted in a sense of this is what we really need to do together. We have no other choice. It's not just xenophobia and anti-Islamic feeling and all. There may be elements of all that. But I think it would be profoundly mistaken to assume that the American people are supporting President Bush in a wave of anti-foreigner feeling. They are, in my view, they are supporting them because any society attacked in its homeland in that way will feel a natural closing of ranks and a sense that the state is the only serious device they have got to look after themselves with. Now, there are foreign policy, of course, operates in two bits of the political space, one the international and one the actual domestic, the international domestic overlap. Even the international has two sets of goals attached to it. Arnold Wolf has famously, and I think insightfully, distinguished between possessional and milieu goals. Possessional goals being those things which attach to your immediate stakes, so that if you're Iceland, you're worried about your fishing rights, your territorial waters, more than if you're, Switzerland anyway, although we know the Swiss have a navy. But there are things in which you are a stakeholder, by and large. And milieu goals are those to do with the overall international system, broadly speaking, that you can only achieve what you want to achieve by helping to shape the overall international system. And the challenge of modern foreign policy is trying to engineer a system, or encouraging it, nudging it, which will enable you both to pursue your own reasonable possessional goals and in which diversity can be brokered without disaster, without anarchy, without cataclysmic war. That's what most of us in the business, I suppose, are interested in. But of course, it doesn't always play out that way in day-to-day international politics. States vary in their activism in all this area, in this space, as to whether they're good at looking after their interests, their stakes, or whether they're active on the wider global stage or not. But foreign policy can also be critical for the other part of the space, which is the interplay with the domestic. This is what is known since Peter Gurevich as the second image reversed, the idea that foreign policy affects domestic politics. It projects back into the state just as much as it has domestic origins. And I think that this is a very important thing to think about, that ultimately foreign policy can bring the whole house of cards down if things get very serious. It is not completely inconceivable that even Mr. Blair, with his massive majority and a completely disabled opposition in Parliament, could still lose his position of power if a war in Iraq went badly wrong and the government found itself in a position which it simply couldn't get out of, with terms of heavy losses or massive, not just our losses, but massive losses of Iraqi civilians or whatever. Nobody can tell, nobody can control these things so neatly in international relations, as we know. But even if that doesn't happen, and it did happen to Neville Chamberlain when the Tories had a pretty big majority in 1939-40 as well, it only took 81 abstentions of Chamberlain's supporters, not even a defeat in the House of Commons, to bring Chamberlain down and put Churchill in his place. But even if we don't move away from those dramas, there's still a lot of routine interpenetration between international relations and domestic politics, as we see with this debate now about homeland security and anti-terrorism, the two things being part of the same apple. Okay, what then do states do with their foreign policies? They have a wide range of strategies open to them, and I want to divide them into those which relate to the global reach, trying to look at the milieu, trying to be active in shaping the wider system, and those which are more defensive, more focused, more introvert, if you like. This is really a distinction between extrovert and introvert foreign policies. And I have six of the extrovert foreign policies to go through very briefly, just to give you some idea of an argument, and four of the more defensive ones. Let me take a little time to warm up. Okay, you've got it, it's right. The first of the kinds of things that states do with their foreign policies in the world under this heading of global reach is to be crusading. Now, this can be a pretty dangerous sort of activity for the wider world system. It's sometimes known in the literature as revolutionism or fideism, in Michael Donnellan's terms, or could be the reach for a world empire. Napoleon and Hitler, I suppose, are both very much associated with this kind of approach, but equally they were rulers who fell, who were brought down by coalitions against them, and of course even their allies were rather more cautious and prosaic in their foreign policies than the messianic quality which both of those extraordinary individuals display. At the moment, some people argue that Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney and their colleagues and so on are engaged in some kind of crusade. Of course, Osama bin Laden actually uses that terminology to describe Western policy, and not just since September the 11th either. I personally don't think that, although I disapprove of a lot of things that the present American administration is doing, I don't think that they consciously want to overthrow the Westphalian state system or to subjugate Islamic states, as bin Laden avers. On the other hand, there may be unintended consequences of action which go in that sort of direction. One always has to distinguish between intention and consequences. And my own view is that actually the United States has never really flexed its muscles in international relations yet, and it's possible that you ain't seen nothing yet. I hope not. But the United States has such an enormous preponderance of power over any other state in the system that if it were to choose to use its power, which is not just military, of course, but for directed political ends, it wouldn't win every battle. We saw that in Vietnam. But it would be able to shape other people's circumstances even more profoundly than it currently does, which it probably does more through soft power than anything else up to the present. Names like Stalin and Mao are also associated in the Cold War with a kind of crusading messianic approach to foreign policy. I would have thought now, looking back with hindsight and historical scholarship, most of us would feel that their ambitions, their crusading qualities were greatly exaggerated by the West. Not to say they were pleasant or desirable regimes, but nonetheless, they fall perhaps more into the category of autocracies being cautious in their foreign policies and not simply doing what people always assume, that an unpleasant regime will turn out to want to conquer the world. The second kind of strategy is revisionism, which is a rather more limited version of the same thing. This is where countries have a particular thing they want to change, and they're prepared to do it and break a few eggs to do it, to make the omelette, and this may have systemic consequences, but they're not necessarily after world empire. There is a sort of an end in sight, if you like, a substantive quality to it. You could argue the American Monroe Doctrine, the desire to get the Europeans out of Latin America, the scramble for Africa, the Anglo-French, German, Belgian imperialism in Africa, which eventually had its own backwash, second image reversed into the conflict in Europe. Israel's policy since 1967 has been revisionist in the sense that Israel wants more secure borders, and to do it, to get those, it is prepared to expand and to colonize if necessary. And this form of revisionism, whatever you think of the rights and wrongs of it, has undoubtedly had very significant consequences on the politics of the region and of the politics of the wider international system. And of course, Iraq, certainly a revisionist power, attacks on Iran and on Kuwait, which have destabilized the zone in which it exists, which didn't have to happen, of course. Thirdly, I'll try to zip through these rather quickly, simple assertive power politics. This is kind of non-specific, doesn't want to totally take over the world, doesn't have any particular thing that it's determined to get. I mean, even Hitler started with Lebensraum. You know, there was an argument about something which it wanted, or all Germans in the same country tended to go beyond that. This is kind of, if you like, an assumption so inbuilt that realism is the way of the world that you end up having a self-fulfilling prophecy. You end up behaving in a bullying kind of way and without respect for any common understandings of a more cooperative kind. Perhaps a bit less common these days, I would say that Leonid Brezhnev was perhaps one of the arch exponents of it in modern times. But we could argue that the acquisition of nuclear weapons is a sign that some states feel that they've got to give themselves, India and Pakistan, the capability to be able to count for something, to be able to throw their weight around in international relations a bit more. The debates in both Germany and India as to whether these countries need to be more nationally self-assertive, to look after their own interests as opposed to the wider milieu interests, are perhaps might be straws in the wind. The fact that the permanent members of the UN Security Council have absolutely no intention of giving up their own nuclear weapons, even while preaching non-proliferation to others. These are all signs that assertive power politics have not completely disappeared. The Europeans and the Americans like to think that they're doing good works in the Balkans, but of course in some ways it can be argued that they are imposing protectorates of a rather old-fashioned kind, deciding the politics of that region for reasons which they are convinced are good ones. The fourth category, and of course these categories are not watertight, they overlap. One can argue that they, you know, sometimes states flip-flop between them, is leadership. This is a rather specific thing in international relations. We often talk about the United States seeking leadership in the international system or somebody else wanting to rival American leadership. And of course, during the Cold War, there was an explicit rivalry between the two superpowers on this matter. Now, of course, we find ourselves in a kind of political vacuum where we can't think of any alternatives to American leadership, and yet we sometimes still complain about the Americans not providing good or moral leadership. What are the alternatives? Perhaps we don't need leadership at all. Maybe the EU, as Tony Blair said, should become a superpower and therefore be capable of leadership in the international system, or some states, EU states, on behalf of the EU. Perhaps China, 50 years down the road, will be attempting to exert the kind of activism and leadership which it has not so far sought to do. The fifth is what I call directive multilateralism. That is to say that some foreign policies may act to galvanize groups of states to do certain things in common. These can be issue-based, like the Marshall Plan or Malaysia and the Asian values debate, trying to carry the moral argument to the West, Australia and the Cairns group of agricultural exporting countries concerned to rebalance the world trading system. Or they might be regional coalitions, the EU's great historical project to try and organize international relations, at least in its own continent, in a more civilized and stable way. And that project itself, given tremendous dynamism and leadership, if you like, by the Franco-German locomotive, especially in the 1980s. Other regional coalitions have not, on the whole, managed to get anywhere near that kind of level of the EU, but one can still look at ASEAN, CARICOM, Mercosur, the New African Union, all the Contadora group, all of which have had aspirations to become foreign policy coalitions to provide some kind of new organizing principle in international affairs. And the last of these global levels is what I call exemplary foreign policy. This is not having the capacity to lead in any organizational or politically directive way, but providing through, if you like, an example or a symbol or a moral line, some way of holding up the possibility of change to others who will be attracted to it like iron filings to a magnet. One could say that Nehru's India, with its concern for non-alignment, third world, foreign policies had an influence beyond its capability in its early years. Mandela, obviously, Mandela's South Africa had tremendous moral responsibility, although, as Jack Spence once pointed out, reputation as an instrument of foreign policy is a declining asset, and certainly President Mbeki doesn't seem to have been capable of carrying forward that kind of element of charisma in foreign policy which Mandela inevitably had. And again, the EU, which sees itself as a model and as a magnet in international affairs, and that even if it hasn't got the power, the muscle, to do what the United States does, can still act as something which makes other countries want to join in on its project, wants to be in it, and wants to accept the lead given by a civilian power. So you can see that, I hope you can see, that there is a wide range of different sorts of activities, even at this rather ambitious global or milieu level, that US hyperpower doesn't close off all the spaces towards everyone for everyone else. Then there are the more defensive strategies, which are open to the states in less favourable positions, or perhaps with less ambition to start with. And making a slight mess of this. And the most obvious of these, I'm going down the continuum really all the time, from extroversion to introversion. Survival. For plenty of states, mere survival in international relations against a rapacious neighbour or an inherently unstable set of circumstances requires a huge investment of political, diplomatic and economic energy. Arguably, some countries have invested too much in this for their own good or for the necessary circumstances. Switzerland and Sweden, both neutral states, of course, ended up armed to the teeth and extremely concerned about threats which possibly were not quite as massive as they thought, and they should have been able to free ride rather more than they imagined. But there are countries with very real dilemmas. Jordan, one of the most vulnerable positions in international relations. During the Cold War, Yugoslavia and Romania as well, having to engage in a very, very delicate balancing act in order to try and preserve the space, the air pocket, if you like, the autonomy for themselves. My lamented colleague Michael Leifer's last book was on Singapore, Coping with Vulnerability, a very good description of Singapore's, and not just Singapore's, position in the world, and he outlined extremely lucidly that size and location should not add up to destiny. In other words, you can do things even with a bad hand of cards, and the Singapore administration under Lee Kuan Yew and his successors have certainly shown extraordinary creativity and nerve in handling a rather difficult situation. Perhaps Taiwan has done less well, but then Taiwan is not a sovereign state and it's in an even more vulnerable position in relation to China. But it's still doing relatively well compared to what could happen. Then there is the obverse of directive multilateralism. This is multilateralism as shelter. There are plenty of states which want to huddle together in a multilateral framework. They know they can't lead it. They know they can't use it to shape the wider world. But they want to be part of the whole process. Even big ones, Germany and Italy, after their crushing defeat in 1945, knew that multilateralism was the only sensible way forward. It provided a protective carapace for them, so that they could actually paradoxically gradually forge a sense of their distinctive concerns and then voice them legitimately through the mechanism of multilateralism, whereas smaller countries like Ireland or Greece or Portugal simply have made no bones about the fact that they're in a stronger position if they're together than if they're separate, and that it makes no sense whatsoever to be outside. In this country, of course, this is Tony Blair's famous argument. Britain doesn't lose sovereignty or power through being in the EU, it actually gains it. The pooling of sovereignty enables greater strength all round. It enhances your leadership. Well, up to a point. There are still some pretty hard choices which have to be made ultimately about European currencies and European armies and European economic cabinets and all the rest of it. But it's not just the Europeans who engage in multilateralism as shelter. The Japanese and the Australians have also wanted to come under the fringes of the European umbrella for foreign policy matters, and they've also associated themselves, of course, with ASEM and the ASEAN Regional Forum, or in Australia's case, the Commonwealth. Then there is niche, what I call niche foreign policies. These are countries who have managed to establish very specific roles for themselves. By definition, not everyone can have them. You know, you manage to get there first, or it's simply because of the situation you're in. Switzerland, again, you know, there could only be one Switzerland in a sense. Even the Swiss are beginning perhaps not to want to be quite the Switzerland of the past now. But then there are countries who've actually managed to provide effective mediatory services or galvanizing services, but only they could do it, in the way that Algeria in the 60s and 70s, sort of leading the call for a new international economic order, but eventually also providing very useful mediation bit over the Iranian hostage affair of 1981. Norway at the moment. How is it that Norway is able to be so successful, not just with the Oslo Accords, which have fortunately gone the way of all politics, but the current more promising events in Sri Lanka? Is it because they're Norway and they're not the EU, in other words, that they are seen as not having an axe to grind? They are not seen as a potentially overweening power. And by definition, as I say, you can't have many countries doing that kind of thing. And some countries, of course, overplay their hand and try to be either niche or mini exemplar countries, like Jamaica under Michael Manley in the 1970s carrying the fight to the United States and supporting Cuba, when really, when you're in Jamaica's geopolitical situation, that ain't such a sensible thing to do. Manley came back to power, of course, somewhat chastened. Colonel Gaddafi has for decades managed to get away with being a very unique having a very unique foreign policy in international relations, but even he over recent years has decided to trim his sails somewhat and to be more cautious, as he's realised that it's a risky business if you put your head over the parapet too much. And that brings me to the last of my foreign policy categories, still under the general heading of defensive one, and that's what I call quietism. The extreme form of this is isolationism, the extreme form of this is isolationism, as practiced by Hodges' Albania, or North Korea, or the Slork in Myanmar, Burma, and it's difficult to recommend that to anyone. It gets a very bad press. It seems to go against the nature of the modern world, transnationalism, and so on. And also, it has to be held in place by tyranny. So very few people want to be cut off from the outside world in their normal life as individuals. But that means that the bad press that isolationism gets bleeds into a bad press also for quietism. So that when you want to insult British politicians and say they don't understand foreign policy, you say, oh, you want a foreign policy like Sweden, don't you? You don't want to be active in the world. You know, active is so much part of the mindset in certain countries that people can't think that anything could be different. Or they say, look at the EU, it's merely a big Switzerland, as if that was an insult. Well, perhaps it was a compliment, who knows? But in my view, quietism has quite a lot to be said for it in certain circumstances. In fact, the opposite, activism, has very many things to be said against it. And the historical record, I think, shows that quite a few million lives, hundreds of millions of lives have been lost as a result of it. But quietism, if you're Finland during the Cold War, or if you're Iran or Syria now, where you've got a very difficult set of circumstances to cope with, or Bosnia-Herzegovina now, where you know that one false move could bring down the whole fragile post-Dayton settlement. All these situations mean that a certain degree of caution, slow-movingness, if not actual immobilism, might not be such a bad idea. I think I'm coming to the end of my time, Margot, so I won't talk as I had thought I might about a few cases like EU enlargement or rogue states, but I will simply try to pull out my conclusions, which will not be a surprise to you. They are quite straightforward, although I don't think the implications of them are straightforward, and naturally I think that they are important enough. And there are five things I would just like to say very briefly in the last few minutes. First of all, I hope to have established that foreign policy is a site for political action, and political action of a kind which really matters. What states do in relation to each other, in relation to transnational actors, in relation to international organizations, and within those international organizations, don't let anybody think that because we're talking about the UN providing legitimacy for a war against Iraq, that somehow it's the UN which is the actor in all this. We have seen in many ways a most strenuous form of diplomatic and foreign policy arm wrestling of a multilateral kind going on over the last month or so in the framework of the UN. But what these diverse kinds of actions do really matter, and they involve the two kinds of politics that I've tried to outline. One, the shaping of the international political system, which is a long-term project, but some states are in a position to have a more immediate and dramatic effect than others. In terms of shaping also the international political economy, because despite privatization and the power of free market investment and movement of peoples and so on, states still have a very important role in the international political economy. And also in terms of articulating the competing value system that we see in the world. This is not to sign up to the clash of civilizations. It's simply to say that there are different philosophies of politics and of individual human life in the world, and that sometimes these do have political manifestations which, unfortunately at the moment, we see in a rather more dramatic form than at other times. And that different states' roles in articulating these value systems, as well as the role of individuals, intellectuals, and civil society and so on, is of very great significance. The second major conclusion is that a wide range, as I hope to have shown with my different strategies, a wide range of different actions is possible. Despite the commonplaces of a determinist approach to international relations, structuralist approaches which tend to assume there's not much choice, that people tend to respond in similar kinds of ways to similar sorts of situations. In my view, many diverse things can be done and are done. Whether they're done successfully or not is another matter. There's an awful lot of analysis to be done there in terms of the role of decision making, of decision makers, of domestic politics, of how well you use your instruments of foreign policy and the like. But in principle, a huge range of things can be done. There is no sense in which we are doomed to complete inactivity or impotence in political life internationally. And therefore, skill in foreign policy is absolutely crucial, because it's the way a society it collectively interprets its situation in the world and chooses how to act upon it. My third conclusion is that foreign policy is more relevant to ordinary citizens than ever before. If it ever was a closed, charmed circle for an elite which only appeared to smash into people's ordinary lives when they had to fight in 1914 or 1870 or 1886 or whenever it was, certainly that is not the case today. To the classical issues of war and peace or autonomy or an intervention are now added the problems of welfare, prosperity, national identity, culture, democratization, regionalism, and the new security agenda. In other words, a tremendously interesting, challenging array of problems which not only should attach the interest of ordinary citizens, but in fact inevitably will over a period of time, because they have stakes in all these things. They travel themselves, they are drawn into it. That doesn't mean to say that they are disconnected from foreign policy, although it might, depending on the quality of the debate and the political culture. I personally think that the quality of debate about foreign policy and the mobilization of it in most domestic circumstances has lagged behind the changing nature of the issue, and we must try and find ways of closing that gap. But given that, as I said, every entity, every state has an inside-outside dimension, but those are in constant connection with each other, it is a subject of the very greatest and the very widest importance to the general public. Fourthly, despite the broad meaning that I've given to foreign policy and the importance I've placed on it, I don't think that we should exaggerate our expectations of what foreign policy can do for us. It's not a question of going out to change the world overnight, whether you are a messianic rightist or you are a messianic liberal internationalist. Lenin had a tremendous clarity of vision and exceptional resolve, and in a particular set of historical circumstances, he was able to achieve a successful revolution. But even then, only with the help of 3 years of appalling war and the weakening of the Russian state as well as the monarchy. But international relations is not like that. It's not a state that can be seized. It has multifarious activities and actors and dimensions. There are no roadmaps that one can easily chart in it. The best foreign policy planners, like Jean Monnet in the European community, have always built in room for the unexpected. They have always assumed that they're not necessarily going to end up where they would like to end up or they think they're going to end up, but they need to be near enough. They can have some sense of direction, what I call in the book flexi-planning. It's a way of having retaining some broad strategy while being tremendously pragmatic and flexible on the details because of the complexity of international relations. And of course the companions of exaggerated expectations are the famous overstretch of Paul Kennedy and also ethnocentrism of a kind of narcissism and assumption that the world should be like us or we can export our way of life to the rest of the world. And those, all of those things, in my view, are profoundly mistaken and dangerous. But I want to end, and I will finally end, on a note of optimism. I don't want to say that foreign policy is a dismal science, a difficult business, you know, we've got to be cautious. All those things are true, and it's much better to be boring and cautious and save millions of lives than to be gung-ho and to risk those millions. But I think, actually, foreign policy provides us with one of the few points of agency and responsibility and accountability in a confusing and often chaotic world. And we should be able to take the opportunity, slowly albeit, to make it a vibrant and constructive part of our political lives. The modern world is essentially multilateralist. In my view, it's not explained satisfactorily by the single term globalized. But it is multilateralist in the sense that there are many different actors, many different processes, many different issues. And multilateralism requires diplomacy stroke foreign policy. It requires the ability to mobilize political action with any luck in a cooperative frame of reference, with a sense of the limits to what one can do pursuing one's own interests and set of common understanding. But it does mean that there is a profoundly important role for states and other forms of political agency. And in the last analysis as well, foreign policy has to be legitimate. It has to, if it isn't, we can give a technical advice about strategy and planning till we're blue in the face. But the people, the millions of people in our societies, not just this one, but many, many others of all different levels of development, normally speaking, don't have a role in the making of foreign policy. They don't have the capacity to make foreign policy, but they certainly may have the capacity to break it. And in that sense, it would be a foolish foreign policy maker who overlooked the problem of legitimacy and agency. Thank you.
Professor Hill has very kindly offered to answer some questions. We have about 15 minutes at hand, so if you want to ask a question, would you please indicate, but then wait for the microphone, because otherwise we won't be able to hear the question.
Thank you, Chairwoman. It's like in India, we have a port named after you, Margowan. Along the hillside, we have a lighthouse like what you're doing now. It's thanks. And I don't know whether Christopher Columbus landed in that port or not. It's a wonderful lecture, sir. Okay. Of course, so much could be done for the foreign policy. It's not, but there is so much inaction in the shoulder-to-shoulder, you want to project yourself with the Twin Towers. So let us explore this shoulder-to-shoulder relationship. Let us do a laparoscopy. As a foreign medical graduate, when I come to this country, I am not allowed to portray my American qualification. The British consultant, oh, you want to go to America, don't stay here. When I want to come to US, UK to do an American exam, your embassy official, oh, you want to go to US, what are you going to do here in UK? So this whole shoulder-to-shoulder relationship is just a cosmetic. Just you want to, whenever you want to do any caustic things in the world, you want to project yourself. So what we need from Britain is that we're not asking Elizabeth to keep a distance from the Rose Garden. Integrate more with Europe. Let us reconcile with the commonwealth. So that will be, if we may not get a peaceful world, is a more, like your optimistic note, we'll have a better world. So what is your opinion? Because it is not that only you people, you are the only paternal towers. There is a Songkhai tower, as you said. Who knows? There will be ivory tower at the ivory cost. Anybody should be able to go to Sydney Opera House for a good thing.
The question
is, why are you dominating unnecessarily?
What is the question?
Why is that you aren't doing much for? Why is that still you don't want to integrate in the euro because you still think that we the royals we have so much to do.
Okay, thank you.
Right. Well, I think there are a number of different points buried in there. Why integration is an interesting activity. It's in one sense, it is an attempt to make relations which were foreign policy relations domestic ones. And if you manage to integrate different societies, as the United Kingdom is an integrated polity of some kind, then you don't have anything which is left, which is called foreign policy. And indeed, I was recently talking to some diplomats on the continent of Europe who were saying that it's about time that we got rid of the British embassy in France or the German embassy in Rome or whatever, because they don't perform the function of embassies any longer. There's no foreign relations. Actually, I think there are still some foreign relations, even between the members of the European Union, although I would be the first to admit that the relations between the European partners are a very special kind of foreign relations. They exist within a very clear set of understandings, and in many ways they are becoming domesticated, routinized. But when we have things like the Sans-Gat camp issue in Calais, or I remember in 20 years ago when MI5 was accused of spying on French colleagues, MI6 in Paris, MI5 in London. There are occasions when it seems that France and Britain are not actually like Kent and Sussex, but they are separate entities with very profoundly different histories and perceptions of themselves. So what we see is that we are going through periods of change, and we don't know where it's going to end. It may end up in a single state, or it may not. But we cannot discount foreign policy even in the context of that. And the one thing I'd like to add, if I may, is that enlargement policy, which is who shall join this process of integration, is one of the most important foreign policy acts taking place in the modern world. And yet it is hardly ever discussed as foreign policy. It is seen as a kind of extension of European institutional politics. But in fact, it raises profound issues about the final border of Europe, about the relations between those excluded, about what geopolitical entity the EU is going to be, and so on.
Thank you. Question at the back.
Okay. My name is Ioan Nicolescu. Professor Hill, at the beginning of your presentation, you mentioned that you wanted to liberate foreign policy for intellectuals as well as the public. You also pointed out that foreign policy operates in international as well as in domestic arena. My question to you is, what role do you see for public in the execution of foreign policy?
Well, I perhaps rushed a little bit at the end there, but I wanted to say that certainly the public has a direct role in international relations these days. There's no doubt about that. It's a highly desirable business. We are all, in a sense, individual actors in the great game of international politics. We don't have to pour our activity through the funnel of national governments and gatekeepers. But nonetheless, there are differences to be drawn between the impact of you and me as individuals, or of pressure groups, or regions, or cities. You know, Ken Livingstone's a pretty powerful guy, and he'd like to have a foreign policy, and he does, up to a point. It'd be helpful in some ways if he made the trains run on time, but nonetheless, he has a foreign policy. But that is still rather a different matter from trying to work out the issues of EU enlargement, or of Spain-Morocco had a recent spat, if you remember, over Parsley Island in the Mediterranean. Seemed like a terribly old-fashioned kind of thing. You know, why are people still worrying about territory? Unfortunately, they do worry about territory. Parsley Island, with any luck, won't cause any serious problems. But we know that the West Bank and the Golan Heights, we know that Cyprus, we know that Kashmir, all these things still have the potential to set alight regions and possibly even international relations. So this is not to say, you know, we're going back to the kind of July 1914 and we've got to, all bets are off about cooperation and globalization. Not at all. But it would be foolish to neglect this dimension, and that the foreignness can have a danger in the public terms
if it is used wrongly, if it isn't used analytically in the way that I tried to use it, but if it is used as a way to point the finger at the other, as I would have said with the notion of rogue states, you know, it's used to say we're okay and they're not, they're a danger, they must be eradicated.
My question, how can the public legitimate foreign policy when so few understand it?
Very good question. I think that by and large, over the 25 or 30 years I've been thinking about these issues, I've noticed that more and more people are interested and actively interested in foreign relations, international relations, and that there are, because of the development of cosmopolitanism within societies like Britain, there are more points of access in that society to knowledge about what's going on. Now, of course, you could say that in the era of imperialism, there was always an elite which thought it knew about India or South Africa or whatever. But that was an elite. Now there is a much flatter profile to the whole thing. However, countries vary enormously as to the amounts of serious information they provide their citizens with on foreign relations. You only have to compare the... About the United States. Well, you, I'm sure, saw the publicity about the Daily Mirror headline which said that 80% of Americans asked on the street couldn't find Iraq on a map last week. Well, frankly, I don't doubt if 80% of Britons asked on the street could find Iraq on a map. But if that's not the only point at issue here. If in some sense, people are au fait with the basic problem, whether it's the fireman's strike or it's the war in Iraq, then judgment comes into play. You don't need to have technical expertise about whether this missile can knock out that installation or whether this inspection is going to provide the truth or not. You have to, in a democracy, and I think that this is actually a sensible thing from the point of view of political judgment, you have to allow people to make a broad judgment about whether this is a right course of action or it's not, or it's a course of action, whether right or wrong, that they want to have take part in or not. That's unfortunately the rub in a democracy, and I'm happier to go along with it than to go along with the alternative.
Dr. Hill, I find your introduction about different strategies in foreign policy extremely interesting, but it seems to me that...
I'm sorry, the echo...
Sorry, do I have
here.
To repeat the whole question? Yeah, I find your introduction about different strategies in foreign policy extremely interesting. But it seems to me that in your explanation, certain countries pursue certain types of strategies. I think that it's not necessarily always like that. I would like to ask for your opinion about the feasibility and the efficiency, if there is a feasibility, of combining those different strategies in practicing foreign policy of a country. Thank you.
Fine. Well, these were heuristic devices, really, but I did want to imply that countries vary in their, first of all, their strategies from each other, but also maybe over time periods. I mean, there is quite a well-known analysis of American foreign policy which talks about the cycles of American foreign policy of isolation, introversion, extroversion, and so on. Again, these things are never watertight, and it may be, for example, that some countries will engage in leadership and assertive power politics at any given time, and that some countries will engage in leadership or directive multilateralism at any one time. I was simply trying to identify the major different tendencies that one can see. They are not, on the other hand, available on the table as a set of choices that you can take this coloured pencil or that coloured pencil to write your foreign policy with. They are produced by sets of pressures, both domestic and international, and they may be rather difficult to shift. I mean, I think that if you try to explain, for example, why Britain still has a very activist foreign policy and thinks that it should take responsibility for helping to run the international system, and that Spain doesn't, by and large, you can look at capabilities, and Britain has a few more than Spain in certain respects, but I think historical tradition tells you a lot more. Historical tradition, however, in itself is not permanent. Germany and Japan had activist foreign policies up to 1945. Then they were pointed into another direction by compulsion, but then gradually through internalization as well. And now there are well-established foreign policy cultures in those two countries, which make it rather difficult to break out of into renewed national self-assertion and activism, or even the use of military force. Now, whether that's a good or a bad thing is another matter, but it's simply the establishment of a foreign policy culture which is a product both of certain domestic configurations and preferences and of things which have been, in the case of those countries, imposed from outside, or in the case of Spain, which was a great power, of course, like Sweden or like the Netherlands, which were great powers, but over 200 or 300 years have lost the habit of being great powers, of being assertive powers. And then it's rather difficult to retrieve it. And it may be rather difficult, whatever the Americans occasionally say about, you know, we are going to take our ball home and not play with anybody and be isolationist, it may be rather difficult for them to actually do that, to get it out of the habit and furniture of their minds, as Lord Franks once said about British foreign policy.
Do you think that there is any risk, as some have argued, that the democratization of foreign policy may be undermining aspects of the traditional international order? I'll explain what I mean by using an example. And about 10 years ago, Canada held public consultations on foreign policy, which led to a new foreign policy under a new government, which included the concept of human security. And Canada has promoted the idea of human security quite aggressively in the international fora, and recently put forward the International Commission on Intervention and State Sovereignty. And some have argued, I think Robert Jackson is one of them, that this is a kind of global crusading by exemplary foreign policy countries such as Canada, that it undermines pluralism in international society and therefore threatens the established order of international relations. Do you think that there's any risk posed by norm hegemons or norm entrepreneurs in exemplary foreign policy that comes out of this democratizing trend for public consultations
on foreign policy? Yes, I do. I think it's a very interesting point, in the sense that there is always a risk of nationalism and populism, and that if you allow foreign policy to be a powerful instrument of stirring up the polity in a particular direction, and particularly against perceived injustices imposed by foreigners, you will end up with very damaging, possibly damaging consequences at home in terms of your own internal race relations, perhaps, or in your foreign policy, which could become of the kind that we saw in the 1930s. So there is a risk. I mean, we know that in any area of public policy. We know, if we discuss capital punishment, that the more we democratize things, the more we might, or penal policy in general, the more we might end up with policies we're not very keen on for other sorts of reasons. But broadly speaking, I think that opening up a closed area to broader discussion, providing more information. I took part, for example, a few years ago in discussions which the Irish government held with pressure groups around Ireland on the white paper on foreign policy. You know, that kind of thing had never happened in this country. And actually, the Cook-Blair administration did start to open up the Foreign Office a bit and remove some of the mystique and try with various tricks, not all of which worked, to try to engage people's interest in more serious set of problems. And I think there's still quite a long, quite a wide distance between that kind of information provision and the kind of crusading that you're talking about. Although I certainly would not argue that democratization of foreign policy, as perhaps you can find in elements going back of Cobden or Wilson or whatever, is automatically going to be an Irenic foreign policy or a foreign policy which is going to promote the collective interest. I mean, I think that is a sort of category mistake.
We've got a question at the back, and we've got a question down here, and I think I will stop with that one.
I wanted to ask you about the link between agency and responsibility. You started off talking about the state as the site of political agency. Then you talked about Israel's foreign policy, Algeria's foreign policy, but also about Nehru's India's foreign policy and about Napoleon's foreign policy. So it seems that agencies can be accorded to different individuals or units at different times. And I wanted to ask you if it's the same with responsibility. Could it ever be true that a state is responsible for a foreign policy, or is it always the people within the state who hold the strings of power within the state who are responsible for a given policy?
Mm. No, this is a, you know, one of the many 64,000 ECU questions. I mean, agency is a complex process of producing action, and one can analyze it in all kinds of different ways, and to say that it has a narrow base or it has a wide base according to the circumstances one is looking at. But I think a political scientist must be interested in the nature of agency and where agency is seen to reside. Now, responsibility seems to me to be a related but different phenomenon. That is to say that it is about attaching to certain individuals or perhaps political parties, administrations, smaller groups, attaching to these people the responsibility, the purpose of acting on our behalf to do X or Y. It also can mean simply somebody who is, or a group, who are worthy of confidence. That is to say, you are prepared to put your trust in them. It derives from your role in certain respects. In the book, I make the distinction between a doctor who, by virtue of being a doctor, is responsible if he goes out there and finds somebody having a heart attack. He has a professional responsibility to help, but he doesn't have a professional responsibility automatically to help all his friends and relatives who naturally need medical care. The system must take some responsibility for that. There must be formal procedures. And in foreign policy, we should be a bit clearer about who is responsible for what, not just at the level of the state, but perhaps also in international organisations and in the international system in general. One of the fascinating things about international relations is that we do personify all the time, and we talk about Napoleon's empire or whatever it might be, and we talk about the American world order, but nobody is actually responsible for many of these diffuse structures, and perhaps nobody can be. We have got to perhaps focus down on what things we can be concrete about attributing responsibility to and those which we can't.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you a question about the last, actually about the question of legitimacy that you made in the end of your lecture. I wanted to ask, where do you propose to kind of, where does foreign policy really derive its legitimacy on the international level? And given the fact that at least vast regions in the world, if not the majority of them, do not have the privileges of free discussion, democracy, kind of integrating the broader civil society within a democratic, deliberative discussion, where can, in these cases, foreign policy kind of derive its legitimacy from?
Right, well, there are three elements to that. I mean, in a something which one would call a democratic polity, and nothing is perfect, and you know, there are plenty of powerful criticisms we made of democracies like the present. Nonetheless, if a policy is produced by the normal, reasonable processes of law and democracy, then I would regard that as being legitimate as a national foreign policy act. I would have problems when that polity is itself starting to be called into question. For example, in modern Italy at the moment, the monopoly that Mr. Berlusconi has as Prime Minister and as the richest man in Italy and as owner of all the media and as controlling the public media starts to call into question the legitimacy, in my view, of the activities that he might produce. On the other hand, if the Italian people themselves don't call that into question and they seem relatively content with what Mr. Berlusconi is doing in their name, then that's rather more difficult for those of us who want to say it's illegitimate. However, depending on your political philosophy, you might also want to say that, and this relates to the question asked just now, that an action can be legitimate in its own domestic terms, but not be legitimate in some moral sense. Now, maybe you should put another word on that. You just say that it's not something that I would justify. It's not morally justifiable. It's not ethical or whatever. And maybe, therefore, one's splitting hairs over the terms here. I myself would say that if you think that you can do anything in international relations while disregarding certain basic principles like pacta sunt servanda, in other words, international law will have some element in this legitimacy. There is an international level of legitimacy as well, and that ideally an action should conform to both of the two sets of things that I've described. Now, when it comes to countries where there is not the kind of apparatus that you were referring to, it becomes very much more difficult, and we see this at the moment in the case of Iraq. Are we to say that the Saddam Hussein's popularity, because obviously nobody turns out 100% in elections, let alone votes for the same candidate, is ipso facto illegitimate? Or are we to say that by and large the Iraqi people, however deluded they may be, still prefer Saddam Hussein to a foreigner coming in being imposed as a kind of governor general of that country. That's a rather more difficult one, for which I have no easy answer. I think that one simply has to try and see, actually. At the moment, clearly, Saddam Hussein clearly has got so much control of the means of expression and political life that one would have to assume that his popularity is almost entirely manufactured. But I wouldn't put a large amount of money on American and British troops being greeted by applauding crowds in the way that they were in Paris in August 1944.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure that you would like to join me in thanking Christopher for launching our anniversary celebrations, for a very interesting lecture, for answering the questions very generously, and for telling us what is to be done, not only in foreign policy, but also in the study of foreign policy. Thank you, Christopher.